The Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's deputy features editor. This week, what should we make of Macron's election gamble? Who gets to decide how we see the past? And have children's history books been dumbed down? So, Will, we're speaking on Thursday morning. The magazine went to press yesterday afternoon, and our cover piece looks at President Macron of France's decision to call an early parliamentary election following the European elections last weekend. Can you tell us a little bit more about the cover?
It is just nice to get away from the general election in this country, isn't it, as the cover. It's nice to do something away from Britain. And I think Macron's decision did catch everyone by surprise, political allies as well as his political enemies. It does all seem quite mad, and it needed, I think, someone to explain what the thinking might be, which is why Jonathan Miller's written this excellent piece. And he joined us to talk about it alongside Alberto Alemano, Professor of EU Law at the HSC Paris Business School and the College of Europe. Jonathan, in your excellent cover piece this week, you've written about Macron's surprise decision to hold a snap election. Could you explain Macron's thinking? Could you have a stab at it anyway?
Well, trying to penetrate the depths of Macron's five-dimensional brain is obviously a challenge for us lesser mortals. He is fundamentally theatrical, so much so that he married his drama teacher. But this was a grand gesture. I'm not entirely sure he thought it through, but it certainly helped him to regain the initiative. I think it contained, as I say in my piece, elements of panic and performance, and also of a kind of annoyance with his magnificent plan for France has been rejected by French voters. And this was his reaction. And the explanation he gave, that I've heard you, and therefore I'm going to let you make a choice, doesn't seem to make, on the face of it, huge sense, because the choice that I think inevitably will be made will be to reduce the number of his deputies in the National Assembly, and to increase the number of deputies of the right wing, even to the point where it could result in him having to form a cohabitation government with Jordan Bardella, who is Marine Le Pen's dashing young acolyte, as prime minister. Now, that's a recipe for stasis at best and potentially chaos.
And Jonathan, you say in the piece that part of the calculation might be to try and compromise Le Pen and Bardella by bringing them into government, by giving them responsibility of state, and therefore removing the radicalism of their party.
Well, I think radical politics meets a certain sort of reality when they find themselves behind the ministerial desk, faced with the dossier of government. And there's not much doubt in my mind that neither Bardella nor his boss, Le Pen, really has a mastery of any of that. Le Pen was, of course, eviscerated by Macron when they debated, and Bardella recently debated Gabriel Attal, who was the prime minister, and again showed that he didn't really have a grasp of the details. So possibly Macron's calculation is similar to that of François Mitterrand, when he entered into a cohabitation with Jacques Chirac, that he can bring the opposition into government, put them in charge where they will inevitably make a mess, and then come back and reconquer.
Alberto, I'd love to get your opinion on Macron's election calculation here. Is he playing with fire, calling the snap election?
I think it's very important to highlight the European dimension of this French decision. Without the European elections, we would not have had these snap elections. And I find it extremely paradoxical that the European elections are having a greater impact at the national level than at the European one for the time being. And Macron's choice was clearly a choice, meaning he was not legally required to call for those elections. But they clearly accelerated a process that has been ongoing for a long time. Macron is a minority government, Attal is a minority government, and we all sense that it was just a matter of months before a no-confidence vote might have questioned that government. In other words, Macron had very little to lose, but only to win in regaining control of the story, as it has been argued also in the piece, because at the end of the day, the snap elections caught everybody by surprise and are already prompting a reshuffle of the entire French party system, with both the left and the right trying to identify possible coalitions and basically delivering on this clarity that the president is really looking for with these elections. Of course, the outcome cannot be taken for granted today, neither as a big win of the far right or as a major catch-up of the presidential majority. But we clearly sense that today all the elements are there in order to reset the French political system in a matter of 3 weeks, which is clearly an unprecedented scenario for everyone. So it might sound a gamble, it might sound counterintuitive, but in reality it was almost a rational choice where a clear calculus was made in the past few weeks on how to regain control of the story. And I think that's exactly what we're going to be seeing happening. And this, by the way, this is not only a short midterm decision, this is a long-term decision. And we are no longer used to see politicians thinking about the long term. But Mr. Macron, by 27, will be out of office and his political career will be over, and potentially also his own political movement, unless he managed to make it bounce back. And what a better opportunity than having a snap election when you're still the president of the Republic.
Jonathan, what do you make of that, this idea that Macron is really just, to coin a phrase, taking back control?
Well, Macron fancies himself a master of three-dimensional chess. He thinks he's smarter than everyone else. I'm not entirely convinced that the implications of this are entirely favorable to him. I think we may see a situation in which a National Assembly, which has no overall control by anybody, continues as a National Assembly, a new National Assembly, which also has no national control. And the geometry of this is extraordinarily variable, with ructions on the right and on the left. We've seen the attempt by Marion Maréchal, who is Marine Le Pen's niece and who's been aligned with Eric Zemmour of the Reconquête party, which is a sort of splinter right party, to form an alliance with Marine Le Pen, with whom she's long had a feud. This has been shot down by Marine Le Pen, who cannot stand Zemmour. You have on the Les Républicains, who I suppose are analogous to the One Nation Tories, a sort of soft center right-wing party, itself splitting apart as the leader suggests allying in this alliance of the right with Le Pen and most of his party absolutely rejecting this. On the left, you see a coalition forming between the parties grouped that have been grouped under the umbrella of La France Insoumise, led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who, in my opinion, is probably the most sinister politician in France. And he seems to be rallying the left into some sort of unified group. But the unified left has never held together in France. And this, you know, the truth is that these politicians in France don't like each other, don't trust each other, and they may make opportunistic alliances, but where this ends up, I don't know.
Alberto, I'd love to return to a comment you made earlier in this podcast about how the snap election came about because of the results of the European elections. I wonder if you could talk to our listeners a little bit about the gains we've been seeing from right-wing parties across Europe, not just Le Pen's party, but in all sorts of different European countries. Parties that may be defined as populist right or perhaps hard right have started to do rather well. And there was a comment that Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, made ahead of these elections when he said that the next European Commission, it can't rely on the support of right-wing extremists. It can only be based on the support of traditional parties. Do you think that that sort of a statement in years to come might prove to be quite hard to do if right-wing parties keep having this ascendancy?
Well, I would say the European elections have not given away the European project to the far right. Factually speaking, it is incorrect to argue that the far right won these European elections. However, the story is more complicated because, again, these European elections are the sum of 27 parallel national elections that have been following nationally debates as opposed to a pan-European debate. So it's taking time to make sense of these 27 electoral results, to aggregate them and trying to identify which is the political center of power in Europe and in the new parliament. The actual storyline, which has not emerged with great salience, is the fact that overall, the mainstream parties that have been running Europe of the past 30 years, that is the European Popular Party, the Socialists, and the Liberals, overall, they have gained a majority of the parliament, which is a comfortable majority. It's 400 seats out of 720. This will allow them to pursue their previous agenda. But inevitably, this will be influenced by far-right parties, which are not very well organized. They tend to be very disunited within the European Parliament, and they are set to continue to be very fragmented. Because in essence, when you look at the two far-right groups, Identity and Democracy, Matteo Salvini, Le Pen, and then European Conservatives, a group that was established by the Brits a few decades ago, you can see that their figures, their numbers are pretty much the same. But the real novelty is the so-called unaffiliated. These are MEPs who have been elected into the European Parliament. They are over 100, and they haven't decided yet whether they're going to join any of the group. Most of those are pretty much on the far right, but not all of them. Some are populist on the left, the Five Star Movement, or the new Sarah Wagenknecht coming from Berlin and from the new left. And those are not going to be joining the far right. So this far right we are alluding to is not a monolith. It's a pretty rich community of politicians who have little experience of European politics, who might be joining some of the existing groups by actually changing the maths entirely, because the European Conservative groups led by Giorgia Meloni might actually become the third largest group in the European Parliament for the first time ever, by therefore alienating the Liberals, who would lose that position, and therefore also reducing their ability to call the shots during the top appointments procedure. Why? Because in the top appointments allocation, traditional allocation, the EPP get the European Commission presidency. That's why von der Leyen got the job. The Socialists get the European Council presidency, and the Liberals get the High Representatives for Foreign Affairs. But if you follow this logic, and the ECR, the Conservatives of Giorgia Meloni, Vox, and PIS in Poland have become the third group, or that will become the third group of the parliament, they should be entitled to one of those three positions. And this is something that very few observers have highlighted so far, but it could be a really game changer in the balance of power for the entire European Union. And this will very much depend on how the ECR will be positioning itself, how much appetite there will be for Giorgia Meloni to, for instance, join the EPP group and therefore further normalize herself and expanding the pivotal force of the EPP, or rather remain antagonistic and trying to extract a lot of concessions from the outside in order to balance even further the political center of gravity of the parliament towards the right. We see von der Leyen hesitating. She doesn't know whether to look for help on the left with the Greens, as she did in the past, or whether to go to the right. And the EPP is pretty much split because there are so many school of thought within the EPP telling us that at the end of the day, it will be up to them because they have become an inescapable force for any kind of majority that might emerge of this new parliament.
If I could agree vehemently that this was really two elections. I was in Ireland last week, and the European election campaign was being fought not at all on European issues, which were not even being discussed. It was essentially a domestic referendum on the state of Ireland, and that resonates also in France. It was entirely a referendum on Emmanuel Macron.
Jonathan and Alberto, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Thank you.
Will, what else did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
Well, I particularly loved the guest life column, Still Life, this one is, by Katrina Olding, who is the widow of our loved lowlife columnist Jeremy Clark, who died last year. And she is a wonderful writer herself. And she starts by writing about a dream she had shortly after Jeremy had died, in which he came to her in rather a typically Jeremy-ish way. And she recorded an out loud version of her column, so we can hear an extract from that now, because she'll describe it much better than I'm able to.
The other week, my eldest daughter and I were staying with friends in Richmond for the launch of Jeremy's third collection of low-life columns. The night before the anniversary of his death, the day of the launch, I woke at 2 a.m. and, unable to sleep, was back in the cave holding Jeremy's hand, machines clicking and beeping as his life ebbed unpeacefully away. He died at 9 a.m. At 9:05 a.m, in tears and still wearing an IT jumper and flip-flops, I ran downstairs, almost colliding with one of our hosts, out the back door to the bottom of the garden. Beyond the high wooden fence and gate, a path ran parallel with the Thames. I reached up to open the latch. The Thames is quiet there, a great oily mass drifting towards Southend-on-Sea, where Jeremy was born. I stood on the path watching it until in the distance a man came jogging towards me. The book launch passed in a blur. I hardly spoke to anyone, and because I'd had so little sleep, a few drinks and was anxious, the people I did talk to would have been justified in doubting my sanity or thinking I was on drugs. But I did just about manage to hold it together adequately and speak to the company as a whole. I told them this. A few weeks after Jeremy died, I dreamt he walked into the house. He looked fit, strong and full of life. I was overjoyed and said, "How did you get here?" And he just grinned in that cheeky way he did and said, "What day is it, train?" "It's Monday, column deadline day." "Oh, fuck, what am I going to write about?" "Darling, you died 3 weeks ago and here you are, back, at least one column. We're all desperate to know. I'd like to say we embrace, but a dream will only take us so far."
How about you, Gus? What did you enjoy?
I enjoyed two things. One was Mary's column, Mary Wakefield's column on history books, which we are going to hear a bit more about in a second. And also Sam McPhail's notes on Madry, which is a new lager for those that drink lager beer in pubs. Apparently it's taken over.
Next, who decides how we see the past? Professor Nigel Bigger writes a very good piece in this week's magazine about the way in which certain institutions defer to certain groups who are given a veto over how British history is represented. So who has the final word on our shared history? Nigel joined us to discuss.
Yep. Thanks, Will. So I don't know how much of a trend it is. All I can say is that two instances of the phenomenon arose in the case of 4 days, one in Glasgow, one in Portsmouth. So it seems to me that's a trend. I don't know, but it's happening. And what happened in the Glasgow case was someone in Glasgow got in touch, and they were distressed about an exhibition at the Kelvin Grove Museum, which represented the history of Glasgow as being one entirely of involvement in the slave trade and in making profits out of slavery. And he urged me to write a critique, which I did. I sent an 8-page critique to the head of the museum. Being interviewed by the Times newspaper, the head of Glasgow Museums then, as it were, defended this display by saying that they had referred the matter to diverse communities in Glasgow. Diverse must mean ethnic minority communities, I take it. And they apparently had effectively dictated the character of the display of Glasgow's history. And then a couple of days later, I was approached by the Mail, who'd noticed a case in Portsmouth where a proposal to erect a statue to commemorate lives lost by Royal Navy sailors in suppressing the slave trade from West Africa to the Americas had been turned down by a land developer who had referred the matter to diaspora employees in the company. Diaspora, I think, must refer to African diaspora, so Caribbean or West African employers, and they had objected to the statue as being insensitive. And yeah, so we two instances of a similar deference on the part of organisations to certain representatives of ethnic minority communities.
And why? What objection do you have to that?
Well, in the first case, my main objection was to the distortion of history, because Glasgow played a minor role in the slave trade, and it played a major role in the abolition of slave trading, and Scots played a very major role in the British Empire, which spent 150 years suppressing slavery from Brazil to New Zealand. So my major objection is to the history. And in the case of a monument commemorating the Royal Navy's suppression of slavery, I think there should be such a monument. Why not? But my second objection was to the uncritical deference to the views of certain representatives of ethnic minorities in this country for several reasons. One is I've discovered that among West African Britons and Caribbean Britons and Indian Britons and Chinese Britons, surprise, surprise, that there are a variety of views, not one view. So who are the representatives of these diverse communities or diaspora communities? Question of representation. Who are they representing? Were they elected? Then the second thing is, I think some representatives of ethnic minority communities sort of say, well, our descendants were, our ancestors were slaves, and we identify with our enslaved ancestors, and we feel the effects still today of their enslavement. To which my response is, well, you're feeling the effects doesn't mean you do actually experience the effects. You might do, but you need to make an argument as to how the enslavement of your ancestors 200 years ago affects you here in Britain now. And I use the example of my own history. I mean, I have ancestors in the 1700s, 1600s who were Covenanters in Scotland. They were involved in battles they lost against the government. They had to worship their God in secret. They were hunted in the hills by government troops. Do I feel their pain? Don't be absurd. Mm. An awful lot's happened. Now, I'm not saying, you know, that there may be, maybe you can demonstrate that Caribbean Britons in Britain today suffer the effects of slavery, but it needs to be demonstrated, not assumed.
I need to declare an interest here, which is that I am the descendant of someone who joined the Royal Navy in order to get rid of slavery. So I found my ancestors' obituary from the kind of early 1900s, and it said that as a 15-year-old, he had gone to the West Indies and was so disgusted by slavery that he went back and joined the Royal Navy, joined the West Africa Squadron, and was eventually injured and discharged from the Navy because he was disabled. And I feel personally quite offended at the decision in Portsmouth not to erect a monument of his sacrifice. You know, he was disabled for the rest of his life. And as you say, it seems kind of strange that only one set of descendants are listened to in this. And actually, you know, a small subsection of those, as you say, people have very different points of view, you know.
Well, on the different points of view, Nigel, I would love to expand a little on a point you just made about certain representatives of diverse communities. Is there enough scrutiny, do you think, on who these representatives are, how they're chosen, and also on the evidence that they put forward to make their arguments?
No, the answer is a short one. It's no. There's not enough scrutiny, not enough critical scrutiny. I mean, I do think, as I say in the article, if one's being charitable as a kind of rationale for this deference, the argument would be we're talking about minority communities whose views have not been voiced and heard much before, so we now ought to listen to them. And I have no objection to that at all. But what I do object to is the notion that having listened to them, we all agree with what they say, because just like anyone else, what they say may be true or false. And therefore, what they say needs to be filtered critically. But as for, yes, I don't think anyone has. So when the Kelvin Grove Museum goes and consults diverse communities in Glasgow, I mean, how do they choose who they consult? Presumably, they consult, I suspect, this is speculation, they consult with activists. Well, you know what activists are going to think. Did they consult, for example, I mean, I certainly know two young Jamaican journalists who think that the British doing penance over slavery now is nonsense and paying reparations is nonsense. I'm sure they could find some members of diverse communities in Glasgow who don't agree that the... I'm quite sure they could find representatives of diverse communities who think that there's much to be said in favour of the British Empire, and it wasn't all about slavery. So it seems to me, insofar as they end up with a display that completely distorts the historical record, that they're only actually consulting one political kind of representative of diverse communities.
And this does actually have real-world consequences. You point to the case of in Canada of some purported mass graves connected to the Catholic Church. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So in May 2021, it was reported that mass graves of Native Canadian Indian kids had been discovered in British Columbia. And this was picked up by the mainstream press, the New York Times. Al Jazeera gleefully told the world about it, because now colonial Canadians were guilty of mass murder. Now, let's be clear here. What had happened was that ground-penetrating radar had discovered movements of the earth under the surface. Nothing had been dug up, and it was presumed that these marked unknown graves. And then then lots of other communities in Canada claimed that there were missing children or graves had been discovered. These were Indian kids attending residential schools in the 1800s, early 1900s, and it was supposed that they had been murdered, and there were some lurid stories told about what happened to them. And as a consequence of which, some indignant zealots took to arson and burnt down, to date, 83 Catholic churches, because some of these schools were run by Catholic religious orders. Well, here we are 3 years later, and not a single set of remains of a murdered Indian child has been dug up. And according to a book published last year with the excellently apt title of Grave Error by Chris Champion and Tom Flanagan, according to that book, it's looking increasingly as if the whole thing's a myth.
There's a term that comes up in academia and journalism quite a bit now, which is an idea of inherited trauma. One reads about this quite a bit. The idea that from historic evils such as slavery, it's such a deeply evil and very emotive concept that communities can still suffer from the trauma of it generations down the line. Do you believe such a thing exists in some capacity?
I think my response is to say it needs to be demonstrated, right? Just to take an analogy, do I suffer inherited trauma from what happened to my Covenanter ancestors? All I can say is not obviously. Sir Trevor Phillips, prominent man of the British left, is in fact the descendant of slaves transported from West Africa to British Guyana. That is part of his historic identity. Does he suffer historic trauma because of what happened to his ancestors 200 years ago? Well, I guess we'd better ask Trevor. It's not obvious. So, over time, lots of different things happen. And the fact that some of us may have had ancestors who were martyred or oppressed or were worked to death in factories or died in the slums 100, 150 years ago, do we suffer the psychological after effects? Not obviously. So it needs to be demonstrated.
Mm. And just finally, I think sometimes critics of yours might suggest that you have some kind of issue with presenting contested history or looking into things like the slave trade. How would you respond to those people?
Well, if anyone reads my book, page 276 lists a whole array of evils that the British Empire and colonialism perpetrated. And I have never objected to anyone exposing the truth about the involvement of some Britons in 150 years' worth of slave trading and slavery. My shtick has always been, can we please have the whole truth? Can we have the truth about the fact that Britain was among the first states in the history of the world to abolish slavery, slave trading and slavery, and then spent, uniquely used its imperial power for 150 years to suppress the thing from Brazil to New Zealand afterwards. That's the whole truth. Political activists only want us to focus on the period of slavery, and I assume it's for political reasons because that gives political leverage.
Will, our podcast producer has very helpfully handed us a sheet of paper with a sentence on it that says, insert some kind of banter here about the amount of history in this podcast.
Yeah, well, we are doing two segments sort of about history, I suppose, having just spoken to Professor Bigger. But this is rather different, isn't it? Because this final segment's on children's history, or rather how we teach children about history.
Yes, we're going to discuss with Mary Wakefield, one of our columnists and colleagues, about her column this week, in which she looks at children's books and the way that they've changed from when she was a child. And we were joined by the world-class historian and podcaster Dominic Sandbrook. Mary, in the magazine this week, you write that children's history books have got worse. Can you tell us how you started noticing this?
Well, because I feel like a terrible fraud, because I wasn't that into history as a child. And we're here with Mr. Sandbrook, who obviously knows a huge amount about history. But I do have an 8-year-old son who enjoys history. Really, I'd been going into the Waterstones on Islington Green, probably not representative of bookshops for children all around the country. And I just began to notice that every character from the past in children's history books was presented as a child. So, you know, you've got Alexander the Great as a baby, King Henry as a sort of toddler. But because they're presented as toddlers and children, they behave like them. Everyone's going biff, baff, you know, screw you, ooh-ah, whatever. It actually began to give me the fear, seeing all these giant heads all around. And then I had bought, ages ago, a set of books, probably from the 1960s, that Charles Maud recommended, because I'd like to do everything Charles recommends. And I got them out, and there were these normal-sized grown-ups doing serious dramatic things from history, but it's really for the same age group. It's for, you know, 8 to 9, 10, 11-year-olds. And suddenly I thought, my God, it doesn't have to be this babification of everything.
Mm. Dominic, am I right in thinking that you've read all of the Ladybird history books that Mary's referring to?
So I read them when I was little. So I was born in 1974, so the perfect age, really, for those Ladybird books. And they were the books that got me into history, I would say. So I had the kind of, you know, Alfred the Great, Nelson, Alexander the Great and whatnot.
I've got Alexander on my lap here. That's a weird thing, oh, weird thing to say.
Oh, look at that. That is, I love this. Magnificent? Those books bring back so many fond memories. They really do. I think, I mean, actually, I agree with Mary by and large. Obviously, I don't agree that history publishing for children has never been in a worse shape.
I didn't
for children
say that.
Myself. I've kind
obviously,
of got
your
to say
books
that.
Are fabulous.
But when I started doing my own books, which is in 2020, a series called Adventures in Time, I was motivated by exactly the same things that Mary is pointing out. So my son was then, what was he, about 8 in 2020, and I wanted, he was doing evacuees as his big project at school. They were doing it that term. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff about kind of the kids. So again, it's pitched at their level, you know, it's brought down to a children's level, which I think is maybe fine as a way in. But then I thought, they never actually do the history of the war. I mean, they have no idea what is happening. And I wanted to buy him a book. And just as Mary says, I couldn't find anything that wasn't sort of the little girl who could, kind of that approach to telling stories in the past, or too cutesy, or frankly too boring. So a kind of Usborne textbook with lots of pictures and very small amounts of text. And I thought, what he wants, what I would love, my platonic ideal of a history book for children, is it's a rollicking story that will suck the child into the story. And of course, address the child in terms they will understand, but not completely condescend to them.
Yeah.
And as Mary says, it's not, history is, there's a lot of darkness. Children have no problem with that as long as it's properly packaged for them in an exciting story with characters. You know, a child can read The Hobbit or the Harry Potter books, yeah, or whatever it might be. So there's no reason why they couldn't read a similar kind of book about Alexander or Julius Caesar or Cleopatra or whatever it might be.
Dominic, I thought you made such a good point just then. I hadn't thought of it, that, you know, in Harry Potter and in fiction, we see that children can understand nuance and redemption and darkness, and that characters can be kind of good and evil. And yet in history, it's this very flat approach. You know, the bad guys are bad and the goodies are good. And it's a strange difference, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think people are so anxious about history now. It's so kind of freighted with all our sort of often, I think, quite silly and overwrought,
yeah,
political obsessions that we shy away from sort of darkness, I think,
yeah,
is what it is. So actually, I mean, you mentioned, I think you brought up Alexander. I was delighted when you brought up Alexander because it gave me an opportunity to plug my own book on Alexander the Great.
Which is fabulous.
For children. Thank you. And you see, in Alexander's case, when you tell that story for a child, obviously, you can start with Alexander as a boy growing up. He tames his horse. His father's Philip II, all of that kind of stuff. But obviously, there are points in that story where Alexander behaves in quite unsettling ways.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, throwing spears at his friends, massacring people, all the rest of it. I think a child has no problem with that because they are conscious in their own little world that they often behave badly themselves. So I don't think that sort of, you know, those books of kind of inspiring girls from history where everything is incredibly saccharine. Children, in my experience, actually despise those books. It's their parents who force them to read them.
I think it makes them anxious because, you know, all this is attempting to appeal to children and making these figures from the past childish, but it actually makes them unrepresented, this obsession with trying to represent them, because children know they're complicated, morally mixed humans, and they don't see that in history books. So
yeah,
it would have made me anxious as a child, you know.
Yes, I totally agree with that. I think children actually are just as comfortable with moral complexity and indeed intellectual complexity as adults are. Clearly, you cannot present things in quite the same way. But, you know, I wrote a book about the six wives of Henry VIII,
yes,
in which I had to deal with all the different personalities of the wives, plus the intellectual climate of the Reformation.
Yeah.
You know, that's quite a hard thing to figure out how you're going to make that explicable for a 9-year-old, let's say. But it's actually doable. If you can explain it to a 19-year-old, you can explain it to a 9-year-old. You just choose slightly different terms in the way you do it. I think the approach in history now is to, I mean, it's obviously very judgmental. It's very moralistic. It's afraid of darkness, I think. And it's afraid of, you know, the obsession with sort of triggering people and whatnot means that we are in danger of giving children just a painfully sanitized view of the past. So in my books, when I first started sending in the kind of manuscripts, yeah, there were some people at the publishers who were like, really? Disemboweling in a children's book?
Yeah.
And I said, have you ever met a child?
Yeah.
I mean, the children, this is the one thing from this book. This is the only thing they will remember.
Yes.
Is the bloke who had his head cut off and put on a spike or whatever it might be.
And in terms of the illustrations, you know, these illustrations that you grew up with and Charles grew up with and I remember now growing up with too, are sophisticated and dark. You know, as I picked it up, I remembered the arrow going into, you know, Harold's eye in the Battle of Hastings. And that, you know, it absolutely brought the whole battle home to me and stayed with me into my adult years. I'm looking now at a ladybird of the Stone Age and there's this mammoth rearing up over these Stone Age people. And you suddenly feel how terrifying it must be. Whereas if you got a massive cartoon mammoth with goggly eyes, you don't get any feeling for the horror of, you know, being in that predicament.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a cartoonish element to the way in which history is presented, isn't there? That I think a lot of children actually find off-putting. Because I always think a lot of children, certainly me, when I was, let's say, 8, what I loved about history was the drama, the glamour. The sort of the stakes are so high. It's that classic kind of Game of Thrones, you win or you die kind of thing. That, yeah, kids love that.
Yeah.
And if you turn it all into horrible histories, Now, obviously, Horrible Histories has been very popular, so I'm not going to just completely diss
Horrible
Histories.
Yeah, and that's not quite babification, is it? It's cartoons, but it's not everyone's a giant toddler, you know.
No. I think, so Horrible Histories, the one criticism I would have of it is that there's an awful lot. The guiding assumption, I think, in Horrible Histories is that children have an inexhaustible appetite for toilets and anything to do with toilet humour.
Yeah.
And I think the one thing that frustrated me as a parent with Horrible Histories was tell them the story. Tell them the romantic sweep of the story.
Very good point.
Of rather than merely kind of facts about drains.
Mostly it's bodily fluids.
Bodily fluids.
Yeah,
exactly.
There's an awful lot. I mean, there's a whole section in Waterstones. There's one shelf on history and a whole section devoted to like poo. And peak. It's really not.
Yeah. One of the things I find quite strange looking back at the Horrible History books is that the psychology of the characters is very modern. You don't get a sense that these are people that live in a different world. They're almost modern characters that have been transported back into a kind of historical setting.
Yeah, I think the otherness of the past is so important. Mm. And actually, this is not just a problem for children's literature. Children's literature here is just a symptom of a wider issue, which is that I think we are frightened by the difference between the past and today. So in other words, I think academic historians now either are very judgmental about the past, or they turn a past into a mirror, into a reflection of the present and their own values. And if they don't see their own values in the past, they say, oh gosh, that's terrible. Those people were absolutely unspeakable, and so on and so forth. To me, and I'm sure I would imagine Mary would probably agree with this, the thrill of the past is that it is different and that people have mad ideas that are not yours. Yeah. And actually, after reading for a little while, you start to think, you know, you're 10 years old, you start to think and you think, do you know what? Maybe it's my ideas and our ideas that are mad. And actually Alexander, who is sane, or whatever it might be.
And he couldn't have done what he did without, you know, being brutal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The other thing I noticed, which I wanted to ask you about, was, as you said, the level of activism in children's history, in the history shelves. And it's not that they're asked to think about complex issues. They're actually told what side to take. So I came across this book called Stolen Histories, I think quite close to your books, which is about empire and all that. And in the back, there's a chapter called Prepare Snappy Comebacks. And it says, one thing people might say to you in these conversations is, but Britain abolished slavery. You could reply, and it suggests to 7 to sort of, you know, 12-year-olds, and you say, that's true, that was a good thing, but Haiti abolished it long before us. And there's a whole set of these things where you're basically telling a child there's only one right way to think about things that could be complex in the past, and giving them pre-prepared answers. So that kind of shocked me.
Yeah, I have to say, Mary, I abhor that kind of approach.
But it makes it so unexciting.
I think what it does, it preaches to the child.
Yeah.
And it preaches to the reader. And that is one thing I've always tried to do is to, I mean, actually, I think you should do this whether you're writing for people who are, you know, in short trousers or people who are 40 years old. I think you have to allow in any work of history room for the reader to make up their own mind and not feel that you are lecturing them and pushing them into, you know, you are saying there is only one way the idea that there's only one way to think about the past, to me as a historian, is total anathema. And I think the idea that you would say to a child, this is what you must think and this is what you must say, to me that is abhorrent, actually. I think what you should do is you say, let's take a subject like the British Empire. It's actually a great subject. I mean, it's a perfect subject for children because it has so much drama, so many great characters on different sides of the equation, as it were, and so much complexity that you can lay it all out, tell loads of great stories, the British behaving badly, the British behaving brilliantly, the whole thing, and then say to the child, you know, it is for you to see what you see in this story and you to make up your own. That to me is the essence of education, actually.
Yeah.
It's not telling children what to think, but encouraging them to think for themselves.
And that, as you say, that is what they find exciting. That's what will bring them back to history, not having to learn a set of prescribed answers.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Dominic and Mary, thank you very much.
Before we go, we would like to take the opportunity to mention that The Spectator is going to host a special live edition of our daily political podcast, Coffeehouse Shots, in the aftermath of the general election. It's going to take place on Thursday, the 11th of July, which is a week after the election, at 7 p.m. in Westminster. And you can join Fraser Nelson, Katie Balls and Kate Andrews as they try to dissect the election results, a new government and what comes next. Tickets are £35 or £25 for subscribers. So if you're interested, do book online at spectator.co.uk/shotslive.
Will said it started at 7. Very importantly, the bar opens at 6:30 and you might be able to, I can't confirm this, you might be able to get a pint of Madry.
Yeah. That's it for this week, but if you've enjoyed the podcast, please pick up a copy of the magazine to read everything we've talked about in full. I'm William Moore.
And I'm Gus Carter, and we hope you join us again next week.